Chapter 5. Honestly tell someone trustworthy about how fucked you are. Step 5. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. The first time I did step 5, it was with my second mentor. I identified primarily as a drug addict and he is an alcoholic, but it made no difference. The feelings we were dealing with seemed to be uniform. I had 50 or 60 pages of A4 paper covered with dense writing and dense feelings. Some of the resentments I'd written were so appalling and shameful I thought I was severed from redemption forever. Some were so petty and insignificant I was embarrassed that I even remembered them. One by one I read them out, admitting my wrongs to God, ultimate self, pure consciousness, uncaused awareness, myself, and another human being. As it transpired, we were in a beautiful house in Malibu. I was about to start work on the film Get Him to the Greek. I was giddy and elated, but somehow still dissatisfied, and after 5 years of trundling along as a sex addict, I was now willing to surrender further. It was a beautiful environment to be working in, but that was irrelevant in the sense that the majority of my time, maybe 14 hours a day, was spent hunched over the pages of this inventory, untangling memories and committing them to the page. I had chosen my mentor because he was a charming and articulate madman. I could tell he knew the darkness, and he had 10 years more experience than I did. He was an empathetic and kind man, but not a sage or a shaman, not a blanket-draped, white-eyed, mountain-dwelling yogi, just a drunk who had found a way not to drink one day at a time. Like me, like you, he was still mad, but the program is not mad. The program is a map out of madness for anyone who wants to follow it. I recited the list. Column 1, I resent. Column 2, the resentment itself. Column 3, how it affected me. This recitation had an impact that for me transcended rational understanding. To hear myself air all these secret fears and hatreds, these insecurities, punctured the membrane of isolation I had lived in. To see the pattern of repeated behaviours that dominated my life was enlightening. I began to see how I already lived by a program. A repeated pattern is a program. The confession itself, though, has a profound effect which can be best understood by returning to the wording of the step. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Confession returned me to the wholeness of myself and the wholeness of the world. It was restorative. The compartmentalizing and separateness was undone. I'd never before acknowledged the role of fear in my life, that many of my behaviors were unwittingly governed by fear, that my fear of rejection led me to seek out relationships that precluded real intimacy, that my fear of inadequacy meant that even friendships with other men were fraught and unconsciously guarded, that my fear of being alone meant I bound people to me who were not positive influences in my life. Much of the revelatory information did not concern substance misuse at all. It concerned the working of my heart and my emotions. If epiphany is the revelation of essence, then this process induces an epiphany of sorts. When I saw written out in my own hand the codes and patterns that had led me into continual conflict and confusion, I was astonished that it could be understood so formulaically. It was a great revelation to learn that my problem was not alcohol, heroin, crack, bulimia, or sex, but a twisted system of beliefs brought on by trauma and shame that had become the basis of my unconscious program for living. This is a beautiful step. For me, it spelled the end of the loneliness and isolation I have always felt and that I have continually tried to medicate against. Do you have it too? A feeling of worthlessness and inadequacy. A fear of death and being alone. When I first read my inventory of mistakes, fear and hatred to another person, he melted them away with identification and compassion. Loathing of my own body, hatred of people I ought to love, shame around abuse as a child. In each case, he reached across the moat of toxic yet ignored pain and isolation and told me it was okay, that he too had similar fears and cited direct examples. In undertaking this process, you are declaring an intention to change. Confession has its place in most faiths and is, of course, the bedrock of psychiatrist-led psychoanalyses. Freud and Jung listened as their patients evacuated a lifetime of perceived malady. In the original 12-step texts, it suggested that you undertake the confession with the person who has guided you through the program thus far, or a cleric of some kind, or a medical professional. Really, the primary qualification ought to be that it's someone that understands the spirit of the exercise. I wouldn't recommend doing it with a park bench drunk or a Daily Mail columnist. They may bite back. My mentor sat and smoked and listened hour after hour while I unloaded the deadening burden. Occasionally we would reach a big one: child abuse, my mother's sickness, my feelings of abandonment by my father, my obsessive promiscuity, painful romantic relationships, opportunities lost through drugs, and I'd steel myself. Sometimes I'd skip through pages of trivial grudges, barely pausing. He would sometimes stop and analyse a resentment that I had not regarded as especially significant and point out a pattern or identify himself. The main thing was there was nothing I said that was too terrible or too trivial to shock or bore him. He identified throughout, and through this practical communication, an unexpected thing happened. The veil of separation that I had lived my life behind lifted. The tense disconnectedness that I had always felt lifted. It is commonly understood that the opposite of addiction is connection, that in our addictive behaviours we are trying to achieve the connection. Think of it, the bliss of a hit or a drink or of sex or of gambling or eating, all legitimate drives gone awry, all a reach across the abyss, the separateness of self, all an attempt to redress this disconnect. There is humility in confession, a recognition of flaws. To hear myself say out loud these shameful secrets meant I acknowledged my flaws. I also, for the first time, was given the opportunity to contextualise anew the catalogue of beliefs and prejudices simply by exposing them to another. For the first time, hearing the words, "Yeah, but have you looked at it this way?" This was a helpful step in gaining a new perspective on my past, and my past was a significant proportion of who I believed myself to be. It felt like I had hacked into my own past, unravelled all the erroneous and poisonous information I had unconsciously lived with and lived by, and with necessary witness, the accompaniment of another man, reset the beliefs I had formed as a child and left unamended through unnecessary fear. Suddenly, my fraught and freighted childhood became reasonable and soothed. My mum was doing her best, so was my dad. Yes, people made mistakes, but that's what humans do, and I am under no obligation to hoard these errors and allow them to clutter my perception of the present. Yes, it's wrong that I was abused as a child, but there's no reason for me to relive it consciously or unconsciously in the way I conduct my adult relationships. My perceptions of reality, even my own memories, are not objective or absolute. They are a biased account and they can be altered. It is possible to reprogram your mind. Not alone, because a tendency, a habit, an addiction will always reassert by its own invisible momentum, like a tide. With this program, with the support of others, and with this mysterious power, this new ability to change, we achieve a new perspective and a new life. I learned that I had no need to feel ashamed, that I could make amends for the wrongs I had done, that I could address the fear I had always fled, that I could reevaluate my feelings of worthlessness. Why did I choose to live in a punitive version of reality for so long? because I was unaware that there was a choice and I was unwilling to do the work. But if you think about it, any version of a personally authored reality is highly suspect because we are seldom taking into account the cosmic vastness in which we live and the microscopic grace that carries us through life. I don't wake up in the morning and think, wow, I'm on a planet in the Milky Way, in infinite space, bestowed with the gift of consciousness which I did not give myself, with the gift of language, with lungs that breathe and a heart that beats, none of which I gave myself, with no concrete understanding of the great mysteries, knowing only that I was born and will die, and nothing of what's on either side of this brief material and individualized glitch in the limitless expanse of eternity. And I feel love and pain, and I have senses. What a glorious gift. I can relate and create and serve others, or I can lose myself in sensuality and pleasure. What a phenomenal mystery. Most days I just wake up feeling a bit anxious and plod a solemn, narrow path of survival, coping. I'll have a coffee. I'll try not to reach for my phone as soon as I stir, simpering and begging like a bad dog at a table for some digital titbit, some morsel of approval. A text! That'll do. I've learned through the process of inventorying that it is possible to intervene in my thinking, that I have a choice. In the past, a lustful thought led to a lustful act. In inventorying and sharing, I have gained some perspective. My thoughts are in fact the first layer of the outside world. I am not my thoughts. I observe my thoughts. So now if I start thinking about sex on a good day, I will spot it early enough in the process to make a choice. Do I want to peruse this avenue, this boulevard lined with trees, apple-laden with old temptation? Is this going to be good for me? Or should I observe my breath, slow down, pick up the phone and share with someone I trust that my mind, my naughty little mind, was about to fling my life off a cliff for 15 minutes of mild amusement? Confession, it seems, is ritualized and recognized by most cultures. The version of confession practiced in steps 4 and 5 is functional, modern, and connected. The inevitability of erring, the dilemma that all who live encased in flesh incur irascible drives and urges. I unloaded it all and I knew myself better. I knew what I was and what I was not. I knew it was okay to be imperfect and that I was lovable in my imperfection. Holy, whole, complete and perfect, free from conflict and contradiction. For about an hour. Then my mentor flew back to England and the estate agent who had rented us the house for a week called and said a couple who had booked the house for a wedding next week wanted to come and have a look round. Not unreasonable, you might think. Certainly not for someone who had just had the soul-cleansing experience of step 5. Well, let me tell you what I told the estate agent. You cannot bring anyone here. I booked it for privacy, and I'm going to have privacy. I'm barricading the gates, and if I hear the buzzer go, I'll release all the goats and chickens, there were goats and chickens, and flood the place. The estate agent was so distressed that he, I hope it was a he, called the sheriff of Malibu. Can there have been a less threatening law enforcement officer in history? And I had to be smuggled off the premises to hide at a beach cabana until the whole crazy affair blew over. So you see, I'm still quite human. Quite flawed, but at least I was able to put the estate agent onto my next inventory, and I was able to clearly identify which defects of character had blown up and caused this whole unfortunate business. I still haven't apologised to the goats and chickens. The last time I did step 5, it was in a more manageable form. I identified 20 resentments that characterised my problems and read them to 3 different people. Because I have 14 and a half years in recovery, I know a lot of people with more time than me and more experience. In the purest, and likely still the best after dozens of translations and reiterations, Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, it suggests doing your step 5 with a doctor, clergyman, or a stranger. That sounds a bit eccentric to me, and possibly a waste of a hard-won GP appointment. The important thing is that it ought to be someone who will understand the spirit of what you are doing, which is exposing your truest, previously concealed self in a way that leaves no room for deception of yourself or anyone else. I would recommend someone who already has a 12-step program or is seriously tuned in through some other ideology. If I had to pick a well-known person, it would be Oprah, Eckhart Tolle, or the Dalai Lama. But basically, anyone with a 12-step program would be okay. Just don't splurge your deepest emotional secrets on someone who dislikes you or loves you too much. There are three points of connection. We must connect to our earthed and ordinary self, a fundamental self-awareness. We equally require a connection to a higher self, a quiet, ever-present awareness within that some may call God. But we must also connect with others. If you're anything like me, this is a difficult prospect. I've never found life among humans easy. I'd rather be flat on my stomach watching TV in 1980 with Star Wars figures, or flat on my back on smack, or lost in a wilderness of unfamiliar limbs looking for God in strangers' faces. These days, though, I have many lateral connections with men and women, other men and women like me, who share this condition. I know I would not be able to stay clean and connected to this new way alone. Alone, I always return to familiar self-centeredness and then self-destruction. I need to be in groups. I need to be one of a number, a member of a community. Nothing about my outward appearance or deliberate behavior demonstrates this, whether it's my haircut or the way I make a living. Solitude, isolation, and individualism have been my inner creed. Although this program can be worked alone, in that you could go through this manual in isolation, in a cell, if that's your only option, real change and growth requires a connection to others. Is there a self without dialectic? Who are we when we are alone? We live in our relationships. I have to belong to a community. When I first did step five, I felt the aquarium of isolation crack. When I listened to other men read their inventories, detailed accounts of their pain and shame, I feel my love flow out. I feel warmly connected to them. My innate tendency to self-obsession abates. In these relationships that are built on mutual vulnerability and a willingness to help one another, I am invited into unexplored aspects of myself. We live in a society in which we all, as individuals and as nations, compete for resources. We are told this is nature's way. My nature cannot long abide it. I become too lonely, locked within my skin. I am a different man with the people that give me free counsel. I tell them I can't cope with being me, being in a relationship, being at work, being. They, using their experience and this program, guide me out of the illusion of separateness and misery and back to the connection. When my last great romance combusted and I came fleeing from the inferno looking for comfort and peace, it is to this community, assembled around the mutual wound, that I turned. Every time I reinvest in the material world as a potential source of happiness, I am able to return to them when it fails. When religions talk of idolatry, I feel I know what they are saying. When I make something else other than my connection to myself, nature and others, my idol, my symbol of the divine, I get in trouble. If you take away the bombast, the sense that these edicts are being bellowed down from a purple cloud, don't get too wrapped up in relationships or money. Sounds like the sort of thing a grandparent might say. I have an inclination to make these things my salvation. Before this program and the guidance of others using these principles, my MO was to either be in a giddy and all-consuming romance or to be distracted by incessant promiscuity. I was using these means to deal with the intensity of feeling I experience. The program provides a technique to manage this intensity, either by increasing serenity or directing the intensity in a manner that is less harmful. When the relationship could no longer successfully wrangle such intense feeling and it spilled into madness, the people that I worked this program with were there. When I made the late-night phone calls from strange locations, the places you find yourself after a nocturnal conflict, the lobby of a bizarre country hotel, my mate James was there to talk me down from the ledge. Not literally. Bruv, it don't sound like that relationship is working. You want to chat? When reviewing the wreckage of the tryst, Jimmy talked me through difficult relationships he'd experienced and gave me a new perspective on the preceding months and was able to lovingly point out where I'd been going wrong. Importantly, he observed that the relationship had been embarked on based on an erroneous premise. Through inventory and discussion, we could see how I habitually get involved with people on the basis of romantic and escapist drives, rather than earthed domestic intent. Like most of us, I previously saw romantic love as the last repository for divine intention and worship. I thought that a woman could save me, Miss Wright, the one, my true love. This form of idolatry can call upon centuries of romantic love for support, but the idea that another human can complete us is built upon the assumption that we are incomplete, inadequate, flawed. I find this yearning of mine will happily ride upon the tide of romantic love. It is better directed towards a union with a higher self and an earnest attempt to connect lovingly with all people. This is what I nurture in the company of other addicts. When addicts meet as a group, no matter what the addiction, we have come together on the basis that we need help and that there is hope. Like a tribe that have a shared wound as their initiation, the people in these movements come together bearing the same scar. We must build more communities like these upon the basis of our mutual need. I often arrive at a 12-step support group pugnacious and surly, but as I listen to other people honestly share their pain, I feel the protective walls come down. I have attended these groups all over the world and connected with people who at first glance I think were a different species. When I think of the solidarity I feel in these groups, I have an illustrative image that recurs. Imagine walking down a busy city street, the usual parade of glum, staring faces, the anonymous people that we are content to brush past, or when you sit on public transport and everyone is sallow reading some rag or imbibing a dire sandwich, and only terrorism could bring people together. In these groups that people attend on the basis of mutual need, it's as if you could walk up to these anonymous people on the tube or city street and they would turn to you and lift their eyes and openly recite the contents of their heart. I feel trapped in my marriage. I've never got over being abused. I'm lonely. With these silent and ubiquitous truths spoken, the world is not filled with strangers and grey faces, because I cannot help but love people who know the pain I feel. Even if the tune is distinct, when I hear people honestly speak, I know the notes they hear in their hearts are the same notes I hear in mine, that beyond the difference of language is the oneness of language's root. I have lads that I mentor, I know. They call me up to talk about their problems, I know. And removed from the neurological fugue of self and guided by the map of this program, I can see clearly where they should go and I can help them. And as I hear myself telling them how they should let go or meditate or be honest or be grateful, I of course realize the universal truth of simple wisdom naturally applies to my problems. Their gratitude helps my self-esteem. I cannot be as worthless as I sometimes feel when these people have such trust in me. So when I am rattled by the vicissitudes of ordinary life, I find myself suspended by the positive connections I've made with others, all on the basis of a shared wound and help freely given. We expect nothing but truth and support from one another. These connections mean that I do not live solely in a world defined by competition and commerce. I have bonds that are, for want of a better word, spiritual. With the popularization of this program and the technology now available, we can reach everyone. My friend Kevin Cahill, who for years ran Comic Relief, told me of a support group for women in an Indian slum where the members discussed spousal abuse and how to survive it and be free from it. He said one woman shared how she confronted her husband and told him how his abuse made her feel, that he wept and pledged to change. Whether he will or not remains open to speculation, but Kevin said the other women were inspired and hungry. "How did you do it? What did he say?" they asked. As he spoke, I was amazed how, for people in circumstances more extreme than most of us will ever know, the principles of community and support were at work. I feel that this program is a folk philosophy that is always trying to be born, a simple way for us all to relate to ourselves and to one another, to come to terms with the conditions of our lives and our deaths. When my disease is on me, the loneliness and hopelessness seem real. One of the first measures I can take to alleviate it is to reach out to another addict. I continue to attend support groups because I need to be constantly reminded that my condition, untreated, leads to very destructive behaviours, but more importantly, that my feelings of despair are not unique to me and that they are temporary, that I'm just another human being dealing with life. If we all feel that we are alone, how alone are we? If we all feel worthless, then who is the currency of our worth being measured against? Perhaps this program is a personal and social tool that illuminates the truth that religious people have long known and physicists have proven. All the energy that has ever existed has always existed and will always exist. Form and separation are temporary. We are all one. Step 5 exercises. Honestly tell someone trustworthy about how fucked you are. Before beginning this step, ask yourself, have I been entirely honest in this inventory? Have I been clear about the motives beneath my behaviour? Have I reached into my innermost self and asked for truth to be revealed? Am I open to a new truth? Am I willing to take full responsibility for my feelings, perceptions, and my behaviour? Am I willing to fully disclose the most intimate and previously concealed nature of myself to another person? The person we choose should themselves have undertaken this process and have no investment in our life other than a desire to help us. If you don't know anyone, then go to a 12-step organization that most closely deals with the specificity of your condition. Attend this support group until you feel comfortable to ask someone. Traditionally, it's been acceptable to share your inventory with a cleric of your choosing, a medical professional, or even a stranger. That seems nuts to me. I've only ever done it with someone who, 1, has done this before, 2, I respect and trust, obviously I don't trust anyone, that's one of my problems, but I'm willing to change this behaviour, and 3, I don't expect anything from. People that I consider masters of step 5 say it should only take 2 hours, and that's why 20 resentments, if done thoroughly, will provide a clear picture of our patterns and problems and the areas that require change. My steps 4 and 5 reveal that I am, when in my addiction, selfish, self-centered, and think that all my problems will be solved if I get fame, money, power, plaudits, sex, and glory. That I think I am some kind of God, Hitler, Genghis Khan, Jesus figure, and that I can't cope with this world and its occupants unless I have a hookup to a greater source of power than my ego can provide. When I confessed the details of the trauma I'd experienced and the shame that I still felt, when I revealed the things that I never thought I'd tell anybody, I felt relief. I also had to acknowledge my hopelessness, my brokenness, my need to change deeply. Through the compassion and love of those I shared with, I experienced the power of these principles and the reality of forgiveness, of redemption. I felt willing to change not just my obvious addictive behaviour, but also the patterns, thoughts and feelings that had long underwritten them. Ask yourself, why am I doing step 5? Why am I doing it with the person that I have chosen? What is the function of step 5?